Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you saw the email that I sent around asking a couple of questions of you at the beginning. Whenever you have a chance to look at that and to respond, I'd appreciate it. I'll reserve a bit of time at the beginning and the end of each of our seminars to discuss, so if you have any responses right now, I'd welcome them. First question is, what's the most important question that you have about this topic that you'd like to ask? The other is, if you were to walk away at the end of these four seminars saying, this was one of the best series you've ever had and it was immensely useful to you, what would you walk away with? So we're going to cover a whole spectrum of stress mastery and peak performance. First, are there any responses right now to these two questions that any of you have? And I appreciate those of you who have already sent in responses. Any immediate reactions to either or both questions? But one at a time. While you're thinking, let me just kind of set the framework here. I'm eager to begin in this collaboration with you on what I think is a really important area in professional coaching of stress mastery, and especially as it applies to peak performance. We're going to look at the latest research and application on optimum performance under pressure and practical understanding and strategies that you can use for yourself and your clients in business, the arts, sports. We're going to cover a range of proven stress mastery tools and peak performance strategies. There's a lot of information I want to share with you. The outline, I'd suggest that you print that. The outline is the synopsis of the important aspects, so hopefully you can listen for understanding and application without having to take a whole bunch of notes. There's also another document to download and print, resources and exercises. And I think this might be helpful when you have time. And as I mentioned in the reminder, this is being recorded for online playback. The ports are at the page you were sent to download the outline, and that will all be there. So my hope is to be able to co-create with you in this collaboration a peak experience in itself. So any responses to these two questions? Most important thing, and what would you like to walk away with? Anyone? When you signed up for this seminar series, what was your most pressing question that you said, well, I'll go ahead and do it and see what happens? Anyone? I'm beginning to feel a little lonely here, guys. I know I see on my dashboard there are a bunch of people out there. Go ahead, please. I talked over you.
Oh, that's okay. I was hoping
this is
Hi, I'm sorry. My name is Tanya Daly.
Welcome.
And
thanks.
Hi.
Go ahead. I was
thank
feeling
you.
Lonely. Go ahead. thank you.
No problem. Well, I was hoping to find the answer to how to deal with burnout kind of stress. So not the immediate, you know, that something is falling on me kind of stress,
okay,
but the overwhelming, that kind of stress.
And I see from your email you're a nurse.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We will touch on that. That's an important aspect in terms of some things that may be important to each of you as well as to your clients. So a common theme, and thanks for mentioning that. I appreciate that. Who else? Anything else in the scope of what you think about right now? Well, I'll tell you what. I will get started. I'm going to put us on lecture mode for the presentation part, and then I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion. Thank you for managing the background noise for the discussion time, and we'll always have a bit of discussion at the beginning and at the end. So hang on.
Dave?
And jot down. Yes.
So I thought you were going to move on to the second question. This is Ron. And
yeah, go ahead, Ron.
I didn't get a chance to look at the questions soon enough, and I'd like to give them more thought. But just in response to the second question, I personally would like to walk away with the ability to have optimal performance under stressful situations. I mean, that's the big picture. But a dual interest is also to be able to acquire the skills to convey the same and empower clients that I would coach with the same skill set to help them to be able to utilize the same.
Well, you're at the right place to do both of those. We will definitely cover that, and thanks, Ron. That's a very vital aspect of what I want to be sure that we do and cover in practical ways, because I think this is something that is so important to really be able to do stress management and regulate states of mind. In a recent, some of you have heard me mention this before, a couple of studies in Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review found that for executives, being able to regulate state of mind and to develop self-reflection were the most important aspects of executive functioning. And I think that's only because that's all they looked at, only executives. That's the case for everyone, for each of us, for our clients, a most important aspect. So we're going to see how important that is and the applications of that as we move into the material. So again, if you haven't, I'd suggest printing the outline and the resource guide so that you can just kind of follow along. That's what I'm going from. I'm looking at the same thing, and so I'll pretty much follow that as we talk. So thanks very much for that. Okay, we're in lecture mode now. Our first seminar, we're going to talk about stress mastery, the strategies, and the tools. First, a brief story of application. When I was in the singles line at Steamboat Springs about to advance to the chairlift, an instructor behind me, who had 5 kids all about age 6, asked me if I would mind if 2 of them rode in the chairlift with me. Well, of course, I welcomed the opportunity. As we got on the lift, the little girl next to me had a kind of an awkward seating, seemed to slump a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we got closer to the end of the lift to get out of the chair, she said in a really timid voice, "I'm scared to get off." And I said, "I understand." And I asked her, "Do you know who Laurie Hernandez is?" It was just after the 16 Summer Olympics. Laurie had won a gold in the team event, silver on the balance beam, and was in all the news. And the little girl looked at me and said, "Yeah." I asked her if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her gymnastics routine. She immediately said yes. I told her that Laurie did 3 things. She pictured herself doing a perfect routine, a vision of exactly how she would perform. Then, the instant before she began, she took 1 deep breath to breathe in relaxation, breathe out any tension, and said to herself, "I got this." So my new little buddy seemed interested in this and sat just a little bit more upright. And as we were just a few seconds from getting off the lift, I asked her what she would say to herself as she got off. She said in a kind of a timid, hesitant voice, "I got this." And I nudged her. I said, "Say it like you really mean it." Then in a voice that seemed to channel all of her 6 years into someone I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said very confidently, "I got this." As she skied out of the chair perfectly, she stopped and turned to look at me from about 10 feet away. At the same instant, we both did a 1-inch air fist bump, both smiled, and then she skied off with her instructor. So here's a brief overview now. In the last few years, we've seen revolutionary changes in our knowledge of the mind and brain sciences and the performance sciences to apply new tools to engineer optimum performance. So I want to synthesize and integrate these new frontiers to help you consistently attain peak performance mentally and physically. Neuroscientists estimate that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means that the vast majority of our responses are based on established algorithms for behavioral, emotional, attachment patterns. This operating system ghostwrites beliefs, emotions, patterns of behavior and attachment, the shadow story system operating on unconscious autopilot. Now, a script refers to the default mode of our expectations, experiences, and responses, how we write our stories. Our expectations inform those attachment and behavior patterns that result in a typical, even a stereotypical, response in certain situations. As we repeat patterns, our brain wires those as the default mode. The script for each scenario in our lives operates largely without conscious thought. At a family gathering or a board meeting, we tend to sit in the same seat each time. We look over the menu, but then order the same thing. To deconstruct this system, to understand the algorithms of patterns of attachment relationships and performance behaviors, we have to examine this default mode, the script. Change involves breaking the script. We can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity, which is a fancy way to say we simply create new behavior side by side with unlearning old automatic behavior. The approaches to changing behavior that work also consider what this is doing to your personal story. So, think about this. How many of you know how to program a computer? Algorithms, pattern sequences? I have no clue. An algorithm is a finite series of steps used to solve a problem or make a decision. We can use this systematic way of understanding to reprogram our mind software and rewire our brains. Now, there are two proven systems that I want to share with you that I've developed to apply to stress mastery and optimum performance. Both are included in the outline. One is the neural conditioning chart. We're going to look at that in more detail. It's a systematic way to identify stressful emotional triggers and to rewire planned ideal responses for peak performance. And then that's the micro system. The macro system is the roadmap system, a strategic way to deconstruct and understand personal performance and to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior. Now, don't worry about all this. This is not a way that I talk to clients. We're talking about this to really understand it because here's the premise. If you really want to change behavior, change a habit, or create a new habit, focus on the system. Everybody has the same goal. Focus on the system to know exactly how to create a map, which will tell you where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, and what's detour and what's distraction. Now, here's a word on the limits of algorithm. This is from Harris County. This is in Houston, where I live. Judge Ed Emmett. For Houston, Texas, 3 500-year floods in 3 years means we're either free and clear for the next 1,500 years or something has seriously changed. Now, science is about patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and world. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way our minds and brains work. So it's not about having all the answers, since most of our operating system is unconscious and not directly accessible anyhow. And it's certainly not about information. If somebody wanted information, all they need to do is Google it. But it's about having an informed framework to ask the right questions and an evidence-based system to implement strategic change for best results, to create, in other words, an optimum performance story. When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum mechanics. her grandmother looked at her material and said, "What can you do when you know that?" Dr. Zdarsky has spent an entire lifetime answering her Nana's question and the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana thought but didn't say as she waited for an answer. And why should I care? We're about to answer Nana's two questions, spoken and unspoken. First, let's talk about, as you see in the outline, several minds, two brains, one focus. A brief word about several minds. A state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process information, how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what happens, what it means, what to do. Each state of mind, each mindset, is its own software system. It's complete and internally consistent. Mindsets frame the ongoing process of our operating system. They include powerful beliefs that inform the stories we write about ourselves. In fact, researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology have recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. The human brain operates like a Google search engine and a Google map, which means we have to really be aware of our story to be sure that all of these maps fit together and that they're consistent with our identity, our purpose, our passion. This is where we come in as coaches. When a new situation arises, a different map's booted up. We have different states of mind or mindsets for different situations. So this says how important it is to understand the context and framing for different situations and to have a cohesive story to organize and direct that series of maps. State always comes first, the state of mind, then the strategy and story. A state of mind boots up a particular software program with predetermined meanings, connections, and internal associations. Within a state of mind, just as with any software program, the patterns are predictable and consistent. When Susan gets angry with someone on the executive team, she will become more authoritative and demand better performance. When Robert is confronted with a challenging task, he will engage an attachment pattern to get someone to make a decision that he's going to sign off on. This systematic approach to breaking the script, from our perspective in coaching, directly addresses the default mode of algorithms that are played out in relationships and behaviors and emotions. We're going to see evidence of every algorithm that's there in our client's brain. To revise the story, we first have to understand the script and then have a systematic way to address change, to recognize and own the process, to assess what to do differently, and to create a systematic way of change. Those are the first four steps in the roadmap system. The initial step of perturbation of the default mode is by definition uncomfortable because it breaks a script and automatic responses. A default mode, the script, has its own continuity, and we feel comfortable when things are certain and when we repeat the past, even though it may be limiting. Every one of your clients, every step forward that's new and different is uncomfortable. We're uncomfortable with change. When we activate new processes that are different and disrupt the default mode, it feels awkward. But that's how we learn. We don't learn when we follow the script and it works. If someone followed your script perfectly, you'd never learn anything new. Of course, that's what we all wish. A stimulus such as a memory, a thought, a person, a place can instantly shift our attention. Once we focus on the stimulus, it boots up a state of mind that then determines how we perceive and process everything that follows. Let me give you a very simple example of that. Whenever we experience something new and different, there's an activation in our brain that we may read as anxiety or uncertainty. Now, the very same way the brain is stimulated that is anxiety is the same as excitement. The brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. So how you frame it determines what direction you go. If you frame it as anxiety, that may mean danger, better head for cover, stop and go back and, you know, go jogging instead of continuing to do what you're doing. Or you frame it as challenge, as opportunity, as excitement, and look at what's next, and then create something new and different that is in the process of change. Two crucial elements in performance become how to boot up an optimum mindset for the task and how to fully develop skills within that mindset for the best results. We're going to talk about those in some length because we know a great deal about that now from the performance sciences. To enhance capacity and performance requires deliberate practice and systematic execution for peak performance. We're going to look at these in detail in Seminar 3. The brain rewires by focused attention on two things, possibilities and new experiences. The repetition of new experiences encodes new learning and neural circuitry. In other words, the brain rewires. So the application here can be, in one illustration, surface and shadow stories. And this is important in coaching, I think, as a way of conceptualizing. Remember, all of this, even the idea of listening to our clients' stories, this is all our concept. This is not a way to talk to clients. I want to be clear about that. Because for a client, they're not telling you a story. They're not enacting their story. They're telling you the way it is. It's not a story to them. This is our metaphor. So the surface story is our usually logical, conscious intention and aspiration. This is what I want from life. These are my goals. The shadow story that often ghostwrites behavior from that 90 to 95% of our operating system that's automatic and unconscious may include beliefs like, I can't really get what I want, or the system keeps me from doing what I need, or this is where unconscious biases or blind spots or inattention blindness occurs. This is where we earn our money. If it wasn't for this unconscious operating system, we'd be out of a job. This is where we earn our money in coaching, is to really know about how to work with, how to collaborate with a client in doing this. So when the surface and shadow stories go in opposite directions, stuckness results. The surface story and the shadow story express the desire on one hand and maybe the obstacle on the other at the same time. The surface story, for example, sees money as security, freedom, pleasure, or worth, depending on the individual and their wiring for what money means. But the same brain may be wired to link it to the shadow story of greed or evil or selfishness or, I just don't think I have what it takes to make really significant money. So this is where we look with the client at the surface and the shadow story. A simple example of a surface story. I want to generate more income and create wealth. But the shadow story, which may or may not be unconscious, is, well, I don't think I have what it takes, or I just wasn't born to have money, or what if I try my best and I really can't do it? We may want one thing, but unconsciously do something else. What results? Reveals which is stronger. And inhibition is often the expression of a conflict between the surface story and the shadow story, simply in an attempt to avoid conflict and the discomfort of conflict. Inhibition, then, stopping ourselves, simply is a cure for conflict, but it creates stuckness. It creates a glass ceiling. The biggest obstacle, and this is important, the biggest obstacle that keeps us from having what we want is the story that we create about why we can't have it. Think about that. I can't find the time. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I may not know what to do. Now, let's look at two brains, the top-down and the bottom-up system. We have two essentially independent brain operating system that have competing interests. This is important to know as a coach, because both of these are going to be your client while you're talking about something else with your real-life client, trying to balance urges with logical reasons. The most pressing conflict is not between us and the rest of the world, but between our two brain systems. We want to save for the future, yet enjoy spending money on a purchase now. We want to be healthy, balanced, with wanting cheesecake with a strawberry topping. The balance can be tipped by adding an extra dollop of strawberry topping off. When we write two stories simultaneously that go in opposite directions, it's not a metaphor, it's brain chemistry. One example is the reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, releases the pleasure chemical dopamine with anticipation of a purchase. Before you buy anything, the pain center of the brain, the insula, responds when we have to part with our money to pay. So, credit card companies happen to know that. So, well, you don't have to pay right now. You can even pay next month. So that's why we purchase up to 23% more when we use a credit card than we do cash or a check, where there's a real life, this is leaving my hands right now. So the bottom-up, system one, runs automatically on impressions and feelings. This is the unconscious system. It's intuitive and automatic. It operates so automatically, it can't be turned off at will. So this is where intuitive and emotional origin errors come from and are difficult to prevent. The top-down, system two, is the conscious logical seat of self-control, executive functioning, and reasoning. This system determines what we do voluntarily, what we attend to, and what we consider in decision-making. So when the bottom-up system prevails, decisions shift toward impulsivity, overspending, overborrowing, overeating, other habits that can be addictive without conscious regulation or direction. A particularly challenging problem is the presence of unconscious biases that we have pre-programmed into the bottom-up system without conscious awareness of the top-down system. So we can have biases that we would even consciously abhor. An awareness of the factors which lower our threshold to resilience against impulsivity becomes essential to recognize. We're going to look at that and some examples of that. Willpower is the triumph of the top over the bottom system. Willpower simply means we stay focused on our goals despite urges of impulses and passions along with the default mode of habits. Also, by sticking to the system, including having a system. So, to Nana's question, why should you care? It's all crucial for deliberate practice, skill development, and optimum performance. That's why we're talking about this. So let's look now at one focus. A pro tennis player was having an outstanding season in her career. We met just before she left for Wimbledon, where she was one of the top seeds. She was having difficulty with her serve, and her usual powerful, flawless serve was strained. And she couldn't figure out what was going on or why. I asked her to take us detailed frame by frame through her usual flow pattern of service to really focus instant by instant, then to describe what she was experiencing now that was different. When she did this frame by frame and got to the point of tossing the ball in the air, she had an instantaneous flash of her coach looking at her critically and experienced that in her body. This literal nanosecond of moving from the flow state of motor memory, of the procedural process that had been developed in her deliberate practice, this flawless, automatic game that she was in performance flow, in that nanosecond got disrupted. There was an interference in flow to disrupt the well-grooved and well-practiced championship pattern. when she instantly and almost perceptibly moved from total reliance on her bottom-up System 1, that automatic superb performance, well-grooved from thousands of hours of practice, to her top-down System 2 to think about what she was doing, she hit the ball slightly differently. At her level of play, this meant everything. Think about in your development of your coaching skill, when you went, as we all do, from thinking, you know, what should I ask next? What's a great question here? To just engaging in the process of flow. How different that is, and how when you're in that performance flow, you're totally focused on the client. You're developing that experience of immersion in the conversation. Now, the power, the reason this is so important, the power is in the focus. The unconscious mind does not distinguish positive from negative or recognize future from past, only focuses on the here and now. This is the power of selective attention. Our brains work like a camera. Out of all the possibilities, what you choose to focus on determines the awareness and aligns the energy field of the brain for attention. Attention holds the key to choice architecture. Attention serves to regulate our emotion and our state of mind that's then chosen for a task. Successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignoring others. The state of mind, the whole performance flow of the tennis player was that well-executed practice, the deliberate practice, the tens of thousands of hours to do it automatically, not to be thinking about something else like what does somebody think about her? A totally different state of mind. Attention holds the key to choice architecture. Attention, focus, regulates emotion and the state of mind that's chosen for a task. And successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining that focus and ignoring others. That's a huge aspect of focus, is all the things that you don't attend to. Think about, and this is a simple example, and I'll bet most of you have this experience. When you do a mindfulness meditation, you get relaxed, you focus only on your breath entering your body, the experience of exhaling. If you have anything else happen, like a thought, you sort of let it float away or let it move away. You refocus on your breath. That's a prototype of focused attention. That's useful to think about because the power is in the focus. Attention, again, holds the key to choice architecture. It regulates emotion and the state of mind for a task. Successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignoring all others. I want to repeat that because it's so important. Attention and focus tells us what to focus on, and what it doesn't say and what you don't engage is all the other stuff. Here's a simple application. My wife gifted both of us with enrollment in the BMW Racing School in Greenville, South Carolina for our 10th anniversary. This was 4 or 5 years ago. It was a fascinating and masterful application of performance science as I saw it, even though I hadn't immersed myself as I have in the last few years doing. We went through various aspects of driving challenges with pro racers for 3 days. Here's my point. One of the early basics they taught us was how to navigate sharp turns and curves at exceptionally high speed. Now, our brains, and this is how they put it, I thought it was fascinating at the time, even more so since our brains follow our eyes, when we look at where we want to go, we create a successful turn even under pressure. If we look at the obstacle we want to avoid, our brain follows our eyes there too, and we get what we focus on. Now, think of this not just in terms of driving, but think about what you want to avoid, the obstacle. If you focus on that, you're going to regularly hit it. This is analogous, and we're going to return to this. This is analogous to you want to play to win. That's the pleasure principle. Focus on what you, rather than playing not to lose, to avoid the negative, because whatever you focus on, you're going to get. When a coach focuses on what not to do with players, let's say an athletic coach, it becomes a prelude to a choke. An individual getting analytical or self-critical disrupts this flow of the bottom-up system to move outside the performance zone to become an observer. The most fundamental principle is one we know from neuroscience and quantum physics. You get what you focus on, not what you want. So look at where you want to go from the next curve to 20 years from now. Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian with 22 medals, including 18 golds, described the significance of focus. When I'm focused, there's not one single thing, person, anything that can stand in my way of doing something. If I want something bad enough, I'm going to get there. New neuronal networks and pathways are created when you focus on solutions, on possibilities. This is the framework we talked about, looking at a challenge, a solution, opportunity, possibility. That boots up a particular mindset in the brain that looks at creating new neuronal networks and pathways instead of looking at problems, which enters an old pathway and even etches it further. We literally mold our brain pathways and synaptic connections by what we focus on. We choose what we pay attention to. Now, we can't control what happens to us, but we can determine how much it affects us and where we direct our focus and attention. A simple example is rather than focusing on obstacles that hold us back, to refocus on things that move us forward and the positive connections. So here's a simple three-step process to counter negative thoughts or self-talk. This is also a way of thinking about the neuroplasticity of change. Reframe the thought as an error message from your brain. Refocus on exactly what you do want and reframe the endeavor for a positive achievement. So this means basically that you're recognizing there are error messages from your brain. You don't have to believe everything you think. So this is your brain's job description to do what it was hardwired to do. And if you automatically have negative thoughts or negative self-talk, recognize it. Use a delete button or simply recognize it as an error message from your brain. Refocus and reframe. So let's talk about regulating states of mind and managing emotions. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. It's like a software program, and we have several software programs. A key element is to become aware of various states of mind with a particular focus on what state works best for what purpose. So the greatest challenge is to regulate states of mind, even though there may be various emotional triggers and charged situations. It is the most important variable to determine successful performance of any type, athletic to intellectual. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach. The meaning determines behavior. So by changing the state of mind, you change the behavior. And here's an application of what we know now. A gap in performance has more to do with mindset than with motivation, intelligence, or talent. When a performer in any endeavor, athlete, surgeon, executive, coach, has practiced essentially the same thousands of hours as the next person, optimum performance is determined more by specific mental state for optimum performance. So here are some factors that lower the threshold for emotional triggers to have more of an impact and influence that predispose to compromise performance. And I say these to be aware of these as you listen to client stories, preset meanings like certain biases, depleted energy, distraction, emotional overwhelm, too many choices, significant emotional charge, in other words, specific emotional triggers, or immediately after experiencing ineffectiveness or powerlessness, or a huge success, equally difficult to deal. We're going to deal with extreme success in the final seminar. Here's an example of how even slightly depleted energy can cause people to fall back into an earlier default mode of thinking and deciding. In a study reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 8 parole judges were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications granted for parole. The average rate of granting parole was 35%. The exact time each decision was studied in relationship, in one sense, to the judge's 3 food breaks, and then beginning in the end of the day. After each meal, 65% of requests were granted. Just before noon and just at the end of the day, when they were more exhausted and had lower blood glucose, the approval rate was almost 0%. And these are people who are trained to make totally objective decisions. At the time of low blood glucose and cognitive strain, their greater fatigue, they resorted to more critical and judgmental thinking. I'll go into an example from a client if we have time at the end. In as few as 20% of people have a flow experience, a performance flow on a daily basis. And some people never experience it at all, but we can optimize this zone of experience for our clients. And this is, let me give you a very simple example of redoing this again and again. One pro athlete I work with came to incorporate and apply everything we've talked about just now about regulating states of mind and entering the flow of his performance mindset in his all-pro career. After every play, because football is more episodic, you don't just get in a flow like you do maybe like with basketball or swimming. It's more episodic. So after every play, and he knew that if he was not in the play, it was going to be harder to get back in the flow. If he did something exceptionally well, he was going to be excited. If he happened to screw up, all of these were challenges. So after every play, he automatically said to himself, reset. That was his cue. He knew that in order not to have excitement or disappointment and to be absolutely grounded and enter that performance zone each time, he had to be sure that he was in charge of that. So this is important because after any disruptive emotion, a big win, a big loss, it can hijack attention and disrupt flow. So we need to find a way to manage emotions and regulate states of mind, especially at these times. Now, I want to just reference an exercise that you have in the outline, the neuroconditioning chart. I think it's on page 14 of the outline. I want to tell you just briefly to introduce it and let you maybe do some work on it on your own, how I initially developed it. A client I'll call Barbara began one of our executive mentor coaching sessions to say she wanted to move to a personal focus for the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays with her family. She mentioned a pattern that each time she goes home to her family, usually for one major holiday a year, she notices the same problems. And she described it with some embarrassment. She said, basically, we have a big family gathering. My parents, brother, sister, their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave, this time is going to be different. I'm not going to get into arguments and struggles with my parents, my brother and sister. I focus so intensely on being balanced and not getting upset. I can usually last most of the first day, then something happens and I lose it. I get in a fight and I'm fighting the whole rest of the time. It's been this way for years. I first reflected, remember state comes before story and strategy. I first reflected on how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family, how upsetting it was for her to not be able to bring this about. And, of course, she wholeheartedly agreed. I ask, at the time you're in the middle of that upset, in arguments with them, what's the age of that conversation? She needed no explanation. She immediately said, early adolescence. I'm all in. I'm 13 or 14, and I'm there totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. I asked her what specifically she was aware of that triggered her reactions. She described, and I asked her for the detail, not just broad brushstrokes, but look at the detail. She described a particular look from her dad, a word from her mother, a gesture from her brother that could instantly create the state change to her reactive mode of adolescent turmoil. I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself, at least 20 or 30 minutes, no interruptions, no distractions, and that so she could reflect on two things. To write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of her family. And I asked her to put this in column one, just to write these down. To not get triggered, but to be an observer of each of these triggers. And I emphasize she remained grounded and centered while she was doing this so that she didn't re-enter this state of upset with each trigger. Then I suggested that for each emotional trigger in column one that she put beside it in column two, her usual response, what thoughts, feelings, behavior, this column two of the usual behavior of an instantly altered state of mind would include things like thoughts and feelings and behaviors, negative self-talk, the kinds of arguments, the specifics of what that behavior was. That's the time capsule. That's her age 13 and 14 time capsule. The things in that column have not changed, had not changed for 2.5, almost 3 decades for her. I suggested then that she also schedule another brainstorming with herself on another day, at least one day in between, where she would think about two things. A mantra for getting grounded and centered for each emotional trigger. This is column three. A mantra is three parts. A cue to initiate the process. Barbara used the cue of touching her ring. That would just initiate the process, remind her of doing it. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain, and a physiology, such as a deep breath for relaxation. And each emotional trigger was then paired with a mantra and a fourth column, an ideal response, to plan beforehand. While it's not in the heat of the moment, what an ideal response would be for that particular emotional trigger, so that she had a map. So this proactive planning instead of a reactive response was a game plan for a personally challenging situation. She sent me the initial draft of her four columns, and I emphasized the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to recognize not just the triggers, the column one, but the state change and the content, the column two, as quickly as possible in order to recognize it and not remain in it, to get stuck in it, to get grounded and centered, column three, in the present moment to then engage her ideal response, column four. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session saying it was the best holiday she had ever had for the family. There were times of challenge. There were times when she would excuse herself to use the privacy of a walk or just go into the next room to get grounded and centered again in order to engage the behavior that she really wanted. And I emphasized doing that she may need to call a timeout. She may need to walk away for a moment from a family dinner to get grounded and centered. she was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. So here's a review, just an overview of these four steps of the neural conditioning chart. Now, the reason it's called this is once you begin with an emotional trigger and go through this process, getting grounded and centered and substituting instead an ideal behavior, when you do it enough, it rewires your brain. So the emotional trigger is not triggering, but cues the ideal response. And even within the mantra, when you do a cue enough with the focus phrase and the breathing, just the cue, just the touching her ring, ultimately came to be a way that she's instantly grounded and centered. So column one, emotional triggers. The first step is to identify the emotional triggers that set that reactive chain beginning with a state chain that set it into motion. Now, you most likely can't change the external cue, but the recognition can begin a totally different trajectory for handling it internally and externally. Column two, the usual response, the altered state, which that thin line between column one and column two is an altered state, a state change. That's the time capsule that you fall into and usually can't figure a way out of. Certain emotional triggers have the impact of creating an instantaneous state change to re-enter an earlier state. Immediately on entry, everything's the same as when the state of mind was first formed. All the feelings, association, perceptions, anxiety, all the negative self-talk, same phrase, same quotes from an earlier time. And this state change takes only a nanosecond. And this shift of state is so common and so imperceptible, it almost becomes invisible. And the compelling nature of it for both client and coach often is to engage in the content. And I'm here to tell you, that won't work. You can engage in the content from now on, and you will never change what's in a time capsule. Understanding, doing therapy, and there I've seen many therapy refugees who have tried to figure out and understand and work through and do all the kind of things from that time cap, doesn't work. You just don't enter the time capsule, or you recognize the process, not the content, you recognize the process to get grounded and centered and enter an optimum state. Now, these sometimes decades-old patterns of thoughts and feelings haven't changed since the time capsule of the state of mind when it was formed. It's always going to be the same inside it. These time capsules house earlier selves, experiences that come from an earlier time and place, yet can be instantly activated with full immersion in the experience of that state of mind. Here's the key point. It immediately seems like the content, the trigger, the self-talk, the messages, the negative assumptions. It feels like these created this state, but they're the result of the state change. All of these are the content inside that time capsule, inside column two. Our compulsion to repeat is unrelenting, yet in repetition we re-enter that time capsule and its unchanging narrative script. This repetition becomes familiar. It even creates the illusion of effectiveness because we know the outcome. It's as if the story we tell ourselves about who we really are becomes who we really are, as if it's our core identity, our reality. And at times, it's hard to distinguish the stories of the situation from the situation itself. Now, back to the overview and conclusion. Column three, the mantra. Here's an example of a use of a mantra, the development of a mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, the team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide of 217 teams. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot, a cue, which he suggested two dribbles, a brief phrase like relaxed and smooth, and then a deep breath in for relaxation. So this entire sequence, 3 or 4 seconds, was while they were doing the two dribbles, the cue. Also, he would suddenly stop them in mid-play and have them go to the free shot line, shoot a free shot. If they made it, they got a break. If not, they took a lap. Because you simulate game situations and the stressful situations in practice. Because in a real game, you don't get to line up and take 30 free shots and count your best. You're fouled, and you're usually off center when you're fouled and go to the free shot line and take a shot. So he simulated that. After 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. Column four, ideal responses. For each emotional trigger, have that pre-planned ideal response, including behavior. This pre-planning simplifies the process to move immediately to an ideal behavior. You got a map for it, rather than have to plan it after getting regulated and grounded. The repetition of these four steps will result in neural conditioning, rewiring the brain. The repetition of the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology will immediately, it's a hard work miracle, will result in an immediate grounding and centering just by use of the cue after you've done it enough. So, the neural conditioning chart brings conscious recognition of emotional triggers that otherwise instantaneously create a state change to an old state of mind with all of its inherent feelings, behaviors, and beliefs. So, in summary, column one and column two, the emotional trigger and usual response are simply to recognize more quickly an emotional trigger and the state change that it immediately induces. Cueing your radar to recognize this as quickly as possible means that you see the process of the state change rather than just getting stuck in column two in the content of that altered state. And like a time capsule, that content will never change. You can't think, reason, feel, figure, or therapize your way out of a state of mind. So rather than getting lost in the content of that state, which is so common to do, instead address the process by getting grounded and centered, moving to a pre-planned ideal response for each particular emotional trigger. As you do this repeatedly, you'll notice two things. First is that as you repeat your mantra of the cue, focus, phrase, and physiology, such as deep breathing, you'll notice that simply the cue alone will be sufficient to induce that deep, grounded, centered state. You won't have to do the focus, phrase, and physiology. This is the first phase of neural conditioning. You've rewired your brain to use an automatic cue to induce a state. I'll tell you, if we have time, what I have used for everything from keynotes to training to running the Boston Marathon with my daughter. Now, as you move with all four steps to ultimately engage an ideal response, when you repeat this enough, it'll rewire your brain. Ultimately, the initial emotional trigger will automatically couple. The initial emotional trigger will couple with a balanced state of mind and an ideal response. That's the hard work miracle. That's what takes time to repeat in order to revise. The trigger won't be triggering, but it'll be cue for an ideal behavior. This is the hard work miracle. Your brain has rewired its operating system. So, elite performers, business, sports, the arts, know and live the wisdom that the more enjoyable the experience, the better their performance will be. Many of you have heard me quote my favorite grandmother repeatedly. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So I'm going to take us off of lecture mode, if you'll manage the background noise, to see if there are questions or clarifications. Anything that would be helpful to clarify or discuss very briefly? I thought we'd have more time, and I'm sorry we don't, about anything that we've talked about. Is this making sense to you, first of all? And are there any questions or clarifications about it?
This is Kip.
Yeah, hey, Kip, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing great.
Super.
Did you say that the ideal response would include behavior, but also the expectation of changing to specific visual thinking or visual imagery?
No, just keep it real simple for that four-column approach. Whenever you have an emotional trigger, what's the ideal response? That may be behavior. It may simply be a self-reflection and feeling confident. Whatever it is, keep it really simple, because when you have a cue, a focus, and physiology and a phrase, you want to move to an ideal behavior, that simply may be grounded and balanced and feel confident. It may simply be a behavior like the example, like what I call a Barbara, that Barbara would have at her family gathering. So keep it really simple, because you want to move to that immediately. Let me give you an example. I think, Kip, you've heard this example. When I first joined, my daughter wanted to do the Boston Marathon from her time in college there, and then realized, oh yeah, you got to get a sponsor, oh yeah, you got to qualify. So by the time she finished her professional training, went back there to practice, she finally qualified, got a sponsor. So we did. I was going to join her, and I'm not a distance runner, so I knew that I needed to develop a mantra to sustain the training that was way beyond what I usually do, even as a lifetime athlete, categorically different. So the development of that phrase then for me was to have a mantra that I could repeat and immediately get grounded and centered in that state that would sustain me through all kinds of pain and other things that I knew that would be sufficient reason to stop and go have a smoothie. So one of my favorite stories is that the fate whispered to the warrior, "You cannot withstand the storm." The warrior whispered back, "I am the storm." I can say those three words right now, and a kind of a chill goes through my body. That's transcending for me. So to repeat that phrase, it transcended fatigue, pain, many, many, I am the storms later. My daughter and I crossed the finish line at the same time, shoulder to shoulder. It's a more complex story than that, but the idea is to have a mantra, whether that's a physical gesture, like, you know, before a keynote, I'll touch my index finger and thumb together, and immediately that induces that state of optimum performance. So the idea is to make it simple and ultimately to make it automatic. Kip, does that make sense a bit more to you?
Yeah, that's great. You percolated me again. Thank you.
Okay. Well, if I've percolated you and confused some others, my work for today is done. Okay, I know we're out of time. Please, if you have responses to one or both of those questions, you'll see it in your email. Send it to me. I'm very interested in what your biggest question is about this entire topic area. What you'd most like to get out of our collaboration together. Notice also that those are the first two questions you ask of a client in your coaching. What do you want to focus on? Where would you like to get to? So this does have a kind of method to it in terms of, this is about coaching after all, too, and how can we be better coaches. Thank you all very much for your attention, energy. I look forward to hearing from you, and we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much.
Thanks.
Have a great week, and take good care of yourself. See you.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Guys.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.